Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Everybody's here. The gang is all here. We've got a mixed bag of our shirts. Wade and Jason clearly got one memo. Matt and I got another, but it's okay. We're all here. I'm also noticing that the guys with the shirts are also the guys with the glasses. I'm not saying that that's empirical, but there clearly is an analysis to be made that if you wear a collar shirt, you might need to also have glasses. So, all right. Well, I'm here with my guys, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, now a member of our SA investigative team, Jason Eisengrind, retired executive from HHS-OIG, the retired Western UPIC director, and now our special director in charge, and then his counterpart, Matt Kachansky, also retired executive from HHS-OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director, and now a manager on our SIU team. And I'm still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, abuse. Today, you know, I think we've been talking a lot in SIU operation parlance, and I think we want to bring back some more of those discussions. We want to talk about audits versus investigations. You know, when we do some of our outsourced SIU training, one of the things that we do is we do a whole slide deck on the different types of investigative tools that are out there, and really with a focus on subpoenas. We talk about what the different subpoenas are. SIUs, while they don't have subpoena authority, should understand that what that process is like, just to be part of that metric. And you know, different types of subpoenas can give you some information about different types of things that are going on in the background. About, is there an investigation? Is it just an audit? Are you the subject of the investigation? Are you a target? Are you a witness? What have you? And there are a whole slew of subpoenas, and we'll probably dedicate some time to a future podcast to talk about the different types of subpoenas that are out there. But I want to focus a little bit on the fact that there is a difference between an audit and an investigation. And I always tell people that when you get that request for medical records, that should not change the tenor of how you're going to go about getting those records. But certainly knowing whether or not it's part of an audit or an investigation can be a discernible difference. So, Jason, I want to start with you because you've talked a lot about this, and that there are differences between audits and investigations. And I think, you know, maybe talk a little bit about how an audit can turn into an investigation or vice versa. So what say you?
Well, the difference between an audit and investigation really is about the outcome. To your point, Eric, about the medical records and securing those and all other information relative to an audit or an investigation, especially in the SIU world, it really is the same, right? I mean, the bottom line is that information is needed to assess whether or not payment was correct for a particular service. And as far as what happens when the allegations are proven as opposed to refuted, it comes down to you know, whether it's going to be an audit or an investigation. Audits generally lead to a recovery. They lead to an administrative action, things of that nature. An investigation has that additional possibility of a civil fraud prosecution or a criminal prosecution or both, frankly. And obviously, those have far-reaching effects on a provider's future. So in terms of audits, the processes that govern audits, there are different types of requirements. So for instance, it might be that the audit is under generally accepted government and auditing standards, or something called the Yellow Book, which is administered by the Government Accountability Office. And at that point, there are steps that have to be taken so that that audit is done in the proper fashion. However, investigations obviously depends on the jurisdiction they're in, and with, you know, whether it's a state investigation or a federal investigation. There are a lot of similarities, but definitely different rules of evidence and different potential outcomes. But anyway, the bottom line is that an audit investigation really requires the same process of obtaining evidence and having findings, the difference is going to be in what happens with those findings.
Yeah, so that's a key point, Jay, which is it's what's the outcome, and does it just lead to there being an overpayment because somebody assessed that it wasn't falling into that criminal civil piece? It's really more administrative and treated as a recovery versus ultimately what leads to a referral to someone, whether it be an internal referral for putting someone on a prepayment review or making a referral over to law enforcement. So, Matt, I want to go to you because obviously the other half of this is that in an SIU environment, similar to in the CMS environment, you've got the MCC, right? In the commercial payer in the SIU world, while they don't have an MCC, there are still kind of these collective meetings to discuss about making referrals and whether something should be brought into from payment integrity to SIU, referral should be made. What do you see as being sort of the discernible differences in when you get that outcome, right? Because at the end of the day, if the outcome results in money that's owed back to the payer, whether it be Medicare from a UPIC related review, the MAC, right, for a referral or something along those lines, the outcome results are kind of going to be part of what that driving force is, right? So what are some of the things that you see as being the key kind of bullet points of what's going to make that determination?
It was interesting. I was just in one of those MCC-like meetings yesterday with the state, single state agency, the Mafuku, and the payer, and I presented a couple of cases. One was sent back to us to collect the overpayment. The other was accepted for law enforcement. And what I saw as a difference is the traditional, you know, what was the amount of the loss? What was the pattern in the billing? Is that pattern continuing? And was there any evidence of intent in terms of, you know, interview results and, you know, and the pattern in the billing? Did it show that they had tried it one way, it was denied, and then changed the pattern until it was approved? Did they try to avoid the prepays that were put on and things like that? So they're, you know, it's the traditional, you know, what's the loss amount and does this have the potential for criminal exposure because of the behavior of the subject? So it was a very interesting meeting in terms of some of the questions that were being asked. They were looking for different ways to, you know, were there different patterns? And so it was an interesting perspective on what the state was looking for versus what the Mafuku was looking for.
Well, and you brought up the point that you were making, which is the loss amount gets down to, at the end of the day, a discussion about the prospect of setting thresholds for acceptance, right? And so just before I go over to Wade, because I want to go to Wade about a little bit of a related issue, but before I go to Wade, I want to just get from you, Matt, about this whole premise of thresholds and the fact that there is no consistency across the country, Mafukus, U.S. attorneys. There are great differences, right? One of the things that I've always noticed was if you were in a very busy healthcare fraud-centric district where they had a lot of healthcare fraud cases, they typically had a fairly high threshold for accepting a case, whether it be loss amount or just abusive, repeated, you know, intent in their mind versus a state or a district or a prosecutor's office that really isn't very heavily concentrated with healthcare. But, you know, thresholds are always an issue, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with 94 different U.S. attorney's offices, 50 some Mafukus, each one of them have different priorities that they're trying to meet in terms of financial thresholds. You know, New York, Miami, L.A., you know, you're talking seven figures before they'll even blink at a case, unless there are other factors, you know, harm to the patients, abuse of patients, neglect, things like that get their attention because A, that's abhorrent behavior from a physician, and B, it's got jury appeal. You know, the rest of it is, you know, they don't have the resources in the office to handle the amount of cases that are coming in unless they set some of that criteria financially to choose the ones that are going to have the biggest impact to the programs.
Right. So this is a good segue, Wade, into you, because you were, as both an agent and as a supervisor in LA, which is one of the, you know, big areas for fraud. It always has been. As both an agent and then as a supervisor, you weren't just working the cases, but then you're the guy that you have to go pitch them to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then you're, as the ASAC, dealing with the, you know, U.S. Attorney's Office there, you're having to go over there and get them to agree to a case in which the dollar amount may not be as sexy as they want, right? So let's talk about that. Like, in these big districts, sometimes the thresholds are fairly high, right? You could have a you know, if it's not $1 million case, they don't want to even talk to you. And then you've got that coupled with maybe it's a lower dollar amount. But, you know, how do you pitch a case in which, you know, going in, the U.S. Attorney's Office may not be all that interested in it?
Yeah, and as Matt alluded to, there's no, you won't see a threshold written down or recorded anywhere, but you kind of get to know what each office will and will not take. So in LA, it really wasn't worth pitching a case that was less than $1 million unless there was some other extenuating circumstance, some, you know, patient harm or just some overly egregious nature to it. But that was kind of our ballpark. Like, if it's less than $1 million, look somewhere else, because we would have other options. A lot of times I'd have a case that, as long as I could get jurisdiction in another area, another district that we had an office in, because the LA field office or regional office, we had offices in San Diego, so the Southern District of California, we had offices in Vegas, in Honolulu, in Phoenix. So a lot of times they wouldn't have as much fraud activity in those areas. So I could assign a case that's technically an LA case and assign it out to an agent from an office that's not as busy and have them work it from that office, have it prosecuted in LA. But getting back to, like, the thresholds, our primary office that we would like to pitch stuff to in our responsibility was with the U.S. Attorney's Office. But outside of that, we had the Deputy Attorney General's Office. If it was a Medicaid case, they worked directly with the MUFUKU. We even took some cases to the LA City Attorney's Office, cases that related to ambulance, like patient dumping on Skid Row, that type of thing, as long as we could get jurisdiction that they would be interested in. If it was a much lower dollar case, we would pitch it to somebody like that, and we'd have more success with them accepting it. Whereas with the U.S. Attorney's Office, as I said, it's probably going to be $1 million plus case for them to even show any interest in it at all.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to a limited extent, a little bit of where the law enforcement liaison role comes in is that that person's job, to an extent, is really dedicated in part to helping shape the cases that the SIU is working for referral, but also keeping really good relationships with all of those potential stakeholders, right? Like the city attorney's office for LA, very, very busy, right? It's like in New York, one of the five boroughs, you know, dealing with any of the individual DA's offices. So you got a busy office, and then being able to have one person be that face or that voice can really go a long way, you know, in helping to shape getting a case over that may have a lower dollar threshold or maybe somebody, you know, would be interested in. You know, when I was in New Jersey for about 8 years, I had a cubicle at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Newark. It was before there was a strike force, and I just parked myself in a cubicle outside of the chief of the healthcare unit's office. And we got a lot of really good cases, and even some cases that initially may not have been that good, but we got the U.S. Attorney's Office to listen to us a lot more than in previous years, because I was there like literally every day. If I wasn't going out in the field or doing whatever, I would just go there for the day, because I always felt like the squeaky wheel gets the grease, that if you're there and you're seeing your AUSAs every day, even if I don't have anything to report or update to them, I have that relationship that continues to go on, you know, and it went on for, you know, 20 plus years over there. And so, you know, that becomes a piece of that puzzle, because even if you have a threshold that is not going to be met by a case, if you've got a good relationship, they'll at least give you that ear. So Jason, I want to go back to you for kind of the last piece of this, which is that as part of making some of that decision, right, kind of full circle, audit versus investigation, sometimes that includes the collection of medical records. And that can be done a number of different ways. And we'll talk about subpoenas and all of that. But, you know, I want to focus for this last piece for those that really enjoy reading the CMS Program Integrity Manual, which is a showstopper to read, by the way. Chapter 8 and Chapter 3 are two of the more important parts of the Program Integrity Manual. Chapter 3 talks about investigations, and Chapter 8, among other things, talks about sampling and pulling records and what they call the SSOE, which has to do with statistical sampling and overpayment extrapolation. So, you know, when we're talking about probe sampling, CMS has in the PIM that a probe sample should be 20 to 40 records. I always tell all of our SIU clients when we're doing anything involving program integrity work for them, I always say 30 records. Make it consistent. You're picking something right in the middle. You can go back and relate back to the program integrity manual. When somebody says, why are you pulling 30 records? You could say, well, the PIM says 20 to 40, we keep consistent. And that gives you that consistency from a program integrity perspective. And then the referral perspective, you can say you took a probe sample relying upon the PIM. Jason, I want to go to you for the last piece of this because you are continuing to be very heavily involved with one of our clients in helping to shape and rewrite a lot of their policies and procedures. The value of having a policy in place, but also the value of having a policy in place that mirrors existing policies or a CMS policy, I think can't be spoken about enough. But I want to give you the last word on this, because when we're talking about an audit versus an investigation, that could be part of where pulling records and your sampling methodology is going to be potentially a game changer for how that decision results, right?
Absolutely. And to your point, and frankly, you covered a lot of the salient important points. So excellent job. But the bottom line is consistency of the application of the resources is going to go a long way in terms of the, I guess, the fairness of the process. But having said that, and I totally agree with, you know, for a probe sample, 30 records is a good start. Bottom line, though, is it's the process is a continuum, meaning that this should still be an investigative health check after the first maybe five records or so, because it might be that, you know, you've seen something in there that showed that, well, wait a minute, or, you know, is there some other problem here that's running through there? Like, for instance, each record has the same exact note in it, and it was some sort of, you know, replication of the language. There could be you know, some sort of test that was done that just doesn't make any sense at all. And so early in the process, I would still have a discussion between the clinician, hopefully, that's doing the assessment of the medical record, and the investigator in terms of how does this impact the investigative plan. So you don't go down a road you don't need to go down and expend a whole bunch of resources you didn't need to expend, or you spent them, but now you're going to be having to do yet even more legwork, because after 30 records, you found out that really there should have been something else done. So that's one thing. But the other thing I just really want to chime in on, because it's definitely relevant to what Matt Wade and you, Eric, said, and that is knowing your venue. What is important to your prosecutors? What floats their boat, so to speak? But also, what environment are they in? Because in terms of Medicaid, states were given a special incentive many years ago to create a false claims statute at the state level, like what exists on the federal level. Some states have that, some don't. And that's certainly, it, you know, really starts to ratchet up the potential recovery when a false claims statute at the state level is there. So knowing that, and then the last thing I'll mention is that, and it just repeated from several other podcasts that we've done, is being able to communicate with your law enforcement partners, and I mean both on the investigative side and the prosecutive side. So if your venues have quarterly healthcare fraud meetings, strike forcers, and things that are open to you as SIUs, I would definitely be there, because it's going to give you some face time to hear really what is important to that team, so that you can include that in your investigative planning.
Yeah, real important point. I know in New York, they do a regional healthcare fraud task force meeting every quarter, and all of the New York Metro stakeholders physically go, and they try to do some limited information sharing, you know, and the like. So yeah, you've got to have that sort of inter-payer coordination has to happen, you know, to an extent on that. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Look, I think in future podcasts, we're definitely going to talk about the differences in the subpoenas and how to kind of deal with those on the provider side. But on the payer side, I think it's good to educate the SIUs on what are the different subpoenas out there, what are the different things that are out there, because, you know, the SIUs get them, right? SIUs get subpoenas. SIUs are sometimes asked to help craft a subpoena for some records that may be requested, you know, and the like. So, I mean, for me, the takeaway is you've got to stay in communication with your potential outside referral sources, where you're going to make your referral, not where you're getting, not as a referral source internally, but your external referral sources. There's a time and a place to have those conversations. And I think, Wade, you brought it right home. The LA County or the LA City DA's office, like New York City Metro DA's offices, probably have pretty high turnover. People go in, they make their bones, they leave. And so that consistency of having that level of communication for things like threshold numbers, or being able to articulate why a case is a better suited case for a referral, and where it's an investigation versus an audit. I think it's a struggle that SIUs constantly have. Is this an audit? Is this an investigation? Where does it go once it's completed, regardless of what that outcome is? So again, there's no set roadmap. There's no set checklist. It's fluid and it's ever evolving. So we'll keep talking about it as long as people keep listening. Although I don't know if people are listening, but at least we'll try. So as always, thanks for joining us. Again, if you're getting this on YouTube or Spotify or something, and you want to get it in the newsletter, send us an email at hello@advizehealth.com. You can get our prior broadcasts, LinkedIn Live, our many OIG roundtables that we do. You can get those on YouTube. Just go up onto YouTube, look for the Advise Health channel, and hit that button that says subscribe, and you'll get them every week. And until we see you guys at the next OIG roundtable, LinkedIn Live, we appreciate your time. If you're going to be at the NHCAA in Dallas, please come see us. I believe we're in booth number 614, but we'll be there for the week. I'll be speaking with one of the directors of one of the SIUs here in the Northeast. We'll be doing a presentation really on the partnerships between SIUs and law enforcement. So come by for that, and then just come over to the booth, say hello to us, and we'll see you at the ATC, and we'll see you in the next OIG roundtable.